Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is day 10 of our Iditarod coverage, and I am hosting from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska, and we are simulcast on KVRF 89.5 FM, radiofreepalmer.org, and calling in from sunny California, writer and director of Mush the Movie. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. Just wanted to say hi to everyone up in Alaska, and thanks, as always, to all the great Radio Free Palmer people.
You know, we're doing well. Excellent conversation back and forth on Twitter and Facebook, and getting lots of good comments and things on our website. So I'm glad that we're able to provide this service. Like I said at the beginning, we're at day 10 of our coverage, and we're looking forward to at least a few more days here on the air. But if not, we're going to have a race ending here relatively quickly. Who's in the top five or six right now, Alex?
You know, we have had a very interesting past 48 hours or so. I believe we've had five different teams in the lead. And right now, Mitch Seavey is in first. He's a couple miles outside of Elam. And then about 10 miles behind him is Allie Zirkel. And right behind Allie is Jeff King, Ray Reddington Jr., Aaron Burmeister, and then farther back, we've got Jake Berkowitz, You're Awesome, and Dallas Seavey. So an interesting front of the pack, and you know, it seems like the crossing over the ice at Norton Sound, which sometimes can be very, very tricky, was relatively smooth this year. So we're very happy about that. After Koyuk, Jeff King got to Koyuk second, I believe, and then he went about 8 miles up the trail and then stopped, which apparently is done several times in past races. It's interesting, I was having a conversation on Twitter with some people about this, and I think that is probably a strategy that was much more effective in the pre-GPS days, because although mushers don't have access to the GPS, every musher who's in a checkpoint is around the information that is on the GPS. And so that rather than thinking, oh, Jeff King is ahead and he's going way down the trail, I think pretty much everyone who was in Koyuk realized that Jeff King had stopped 8 miles past the checkpoint. So that might not have been as effective this year as it would have been 6 years or so ago when there were no GPSs on the sleds.
You know, what I find interesting, Alex, is how fluid it appears that their schedules are becoming. You know, most of these guys plan their schedules out when they begin fall training back in late September, early October. I know Dallas's wife, Jen, has talked about it several times, where Dallas had two plans. One if one thing happened and one if another thing happened. And otherwise, they stick to the plan. And it's pretty commonplace that all of these guys stick to a pretty regimented plan with just a little bit of variation back and forth. And it's interesting that Jeff King, I can't figure out his plan at all. You know, it's very similar to the way that Martin Busser was doing it early in the race. Everybody was kind of scratching their heads about, you know, what's this guy doing? And now we see the same thing coming with Jeff King. Okay, well, he just blew past a checkpoint where he said on Iditarod.com, I believe today, he says that's not common for him to blow through a checkpoint. He usually stops at every checkpoint and has his own little routine and his own plan. So it's interesting that he did not stop today. I believe that was in Shakulik, if I'm not mistaken. And now he's stopped on the trail, which is commonplace as well. But he stopped somewhere past Koyuk there on his way to Elam. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about some of the racers, and I'm thinking in particular Jeff King and Lance Mackey, in addition to being very, very skilled, top of the game, top of the sport mushers, they are also, both of them, and there's probably a few others as well, they are masters of the psychological warfare of dog racing. And Lance and Jeff in particular had a huge, huge rivalry, which I think still persists to this day, even though they're not often going head-to-head in these big races anymore. But Jeff is someone who will be very aware of people's expectations, the other drivers' expectations, the fans and the judges' expectations, and will sometimes be able to play around with that and use those things to his advantage. It wouldn't surprise me at all if that's part of what's going on in this last part of the race. And, you know, it has changed so much on an hour-to-hour basis throughout the day-to-day. And I saw a couple of news articles which were saying, well, it's basically a two-man race. It's Mitch versus Jeff, and nobody else has a chance. And the mechanics of the race, especially we've got about 125 miles from Elam to Nome, the mechanics of the race are such that if it's within an hour or two, really people dogs can falter, the weather can change, attitudes can be bad, the trail can go bad in places, and it really would be a mistake to write any of these top four or five teams off at this point.
Totally agree with you there, Alex. And if I could hit one more point on this run-rest schedule, and I'm looking here at the standings, and my standings are about an hour old. My computer isn't refreshing for one reason or another. But what I find really interesting, Alex, and it really shows the two sides of Iditarod, the front of the pack and then, of course, the middle and or back of the pack. The guys at the front are taking so little rest, two, three, 4 hours tops, where the guys in the middle of the pack, and it appears this way every time I look, it's 9, 10, 11, 12 hours of rest. I just find that so interesting that there is such a black and white between the perennial front runners, the first 15 or so, that as you work your way down to the standings, how much more rest those dogs are getting than the front two. And my only comment to that is sled dogs are sled dogs. It appears, and being a musher for so many years, it appears that they would need the same amount of rest, whether they're a perennial top 10 team or, you know, somebody like Bob Klupach, who's ran the Iditarod since the 80s, or a younger musher like Andy Taggart or Travis Beals, or even another veteran musher but hasn't been in the game for a while, Jason Mackey. Those guys are taking extended breaks at the checkpoint. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, you know, I will defer to you on this for having the boots-on-the-ground experience with it, but it would seem to me that in some of those cases, if they're running younger dogs, if they're running yearlings or dogs who don't have a lot of experience, I would think that the goal for the race might be very different, and the goal for the race would be to get the dogs, to have the dogs have a very positive experience on the trail, and to get them
right
to go all the way to Nome, so that in subsequent years they can be much more competitive and be with other dogs and on other teams that are more likely to be, you know, top 20 or top 10 finishers. So I wonder about that. I also wonder sometimes if the drivers are either less experienced or don't feel like it's worth the time to sacrifice their own sleep and their own rest and the dog's rest in order to make up, you know, an hour. Certainly an hour at the front of the pack is a very, very significant thing. I think an hour in the middle or an hour at the end is probably a lot less significant when it comes to your overall race.
I totally agree with that point there, Alex. I was talking to a good friend of mine, Dave Shear. He ran the race in the 80s and the 90s and did pretty well back then in the early days. And he tells me all the time that, you know, a good run rest schedule back in the day was 6 hours on, 6 hours off, and the dogs and the musher performed relatively well. And then the recent research is a dog doesn't need that much rest anymore. And I know Dallas Sevy has said the same thing, where he is very often taking 2.5, 3 hour rests and doing very well, of course, winning that Iditarod last year. So I do think a lot of it has to do with the musher and how they're getting down the trail, because the dogs, they're able to boogie on down the trail on a predetermined amount of rest. And I know you mentioned the puppy teams, and the guys that I've mentioned before, like Bob Klupach and Angie Taggart and Jason Mackey and all those guys, as far as I know, they aren't running any puppy teams. They're running teams that that have been down the trail 2, 3, 4 times before. So I just wanted to bring that up for conversation about how much different it is between the front of the pack and guys from about 20 on down. I just find that that's so interesting, the amount of rest that each is having in their checkpoints.
Well, would you say then that maybe if the mushers were able to, because we've talked a lot about the idea that most of the time the weak link on the team is the musher, not any of the dogs. So would you say that if the mushers were, you know, either in better physical condition or better equipped mentally for the race, that they would be able to, they and their teams would be able to go farther and not need as much rest?
Well, you know, that's a great question. One excellent example of this is Luan Marquez, who is the Brazilian musher who's running under Vern Halter's kennel. Vern Halter has been involved in Iditarod and Yukon Quest for many, many years. And Luan had worked with Vern for the last couple of years and did very well in all of his qualifying races. But Vern is meticulous about that run rest schedule and how much time that a dog team needs to stay in a checkpoint, and he rarely deviates from that. He really likes to have dogs very well rested, 6, 8 hours, get a couple of meals in them before they're going back on the trail. And the reason he does that, he wants his teams to finish. Obviously, Luan, going into this, said that, you know, he knew he wasn't going to win, but he wanted to have a good, strong, happy dog team coming in to Nome. And I think that's what he's doing. Right now he's on the trail. Last checkpoint was Eagle Island. But he is one of those folks that is taking a really long rest in every checkpoint. He was in Eagle Island, again, back on my deferred standings here. He was in Eagle Island from 3:35 in the morning to 14:32, so 2:32 in the afternoon. So it appears that he left in the heat of the day, which is another interesting concept of why he would want to leave in the heat of the day to run, you know, the next 6 or 7 hours in the daylight versus running at night when it's much cooler.
Yeah, you know, the other part of this equation, I guess, is that it used to be, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, it used to be that the pace of the dogs was a little bit quicker. So teams would, drivers would try to run their dogs at a much quicker pace, and then because the dogs were tired, they would have to take more rest. And in the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, they've slowed the dogs down so that they're going more consistently, but more at more of a trot than a full out run.
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, I don't have experience for Iditarod, but at least in mid distance and longer mid distance races, that is the key. And one of the common things that you hear in long distance circles, and this is a very common piece of advice to new mushers, it's a race between checkpoints. So if you can get from checkpoint to checkpoint in relative time, doing relatively well, you're going to get to Nome as long as you're doing everything that you're supposed to do. Don't worry about the 3 or 4 checkpoints down the line. Worry about the next one. And then when you get there, then you start worrying about the next, or not necessarily worrying, but thinking about that next checkpoint and what's coming up to come as they're on the trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me as someone who is who does not have the experience that you have, but that seems to make a lot of sense.
So, Alex, I'm sorry we went into such great depth on that. We have about 15 minutes left on our live broadcast. I want to make sure we get to a couple of topics today. And again, if we go over our time, you can hear us on our podcast at mushingradio.com. I have a feeling that we may extend a little bit tonight. If you're okay, Alex, with that, I am too.
Okay. I'm always okay with that.
So let's talk a little bit about Jerry Willemitzer, I believe is how you pronounce his name. You know, last night we talked about that Rule 36, and we talked about the discretion that the race marshal has on whether to withdraw a musher or make him scratch. And lo and behold, less than 24 hours after that conversation, we have a withdrawn musher, Jerry Willemitzer, and we believe it's because of a lost dog and him having to stay so long in Iditarod looking for that dog, and that's the reason why he was withdrawn. What have you heard?
What I've heard is, and we had, I apologize, we seem to have reported some information that we had that turned out not to be correct. So he had a dog that was separated from the team, and he was looking for the dog around Iditarod. We had heard right before we got off the air yesterday that that the dog had been recovered and that he was continuing on. Apparently what happened is he had moved a little bit further up the trail and was significantly far away from Iditarod, and I believe the dog was recovered around the Iditarod checkpoint, and he was already many, many hours down the trail and was too far to come back, or chose not to come back and get the dog and then continue. So it was the case that he didn't have all of his dogs and was forced to withdraw because he wasn't willing to go back and, you know, double track and then come back all the way that he had gone to get to the next checkpoint.
Well, you know, I can only imagine what some of the armchair mushers would say to that, about the guy just leaving the dog behind and working his way down the trail. What's your opinion of that?
You know, I try never to make judgments about that because I'm sure that there's a lot that goes into it, and I can't imagine anything more scary than losing one of your dogs. My understanding is that he thought that he was he thought that he was going in the direction where the dog was. So it wasn't so much that he was trying to leave the dog behind, which he couldn't do anyway, but that he was making his best effort to go where the dog was and retrieve the dog.
So he was quote unquote chasing after the dog then?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's better news than the other side of that, meaning, well, you know what, I'm going to continue on down the trail, I'll just leave the dog behind and let somebody recover him. So it's good to hear that point of view. I think that will make a lot of mushing fans happier than the alternative.
Yeah, and, you know, we did mention yesterday that this is not the first time that Jerry Willemitzer has had a problem with a dog getting away from his team. So I'm not really sure what the circumstances were the last time, but certainly that's not something that you ever want to have happen if there's anything you can do to avoid it.
Exactly. And it does occur, folks, that if they haven't been involved with mushing, it does occur from time to time. I know that I've just on a training run a couple of weeks ago with my wife, Michelle, and I, we were out on one of the local trails, and the brake popped, and one of our young dogs, Shock, slipped out of her harness and was running onto the lake by herself. So it is common that can happen. So you know, fortunately in our case, he just ran up to the other team and wanted to be a part of everybody that was running with him. So he didn't run too far off, and we were able to scoop him up in pretty short fair there, but it does occur. Dogs can slip out of their harnesses, or more common, as we've mentioned on the show, dogs can be tied down in their bag for one period or another and get very antsy and want to jump out. Often dogs will go into the bag for or fatigue or being tired or a slight injury or something, and very quickly, usually within a half an hour, if it's just fatigue, that dog will jump up in the bag and be ready to go, and he'll do whatever he can to get out of that bag and be back on the trail. Dogs often do not want to sit in that bag and take that taxi ride for hour upon hour.
Yeah, what some people who haven't been around a lot of sled dogs don't understand or don't really appreciate is that these dogs just live to rut. That's if there's anything happier than a sled dog who is running down the trail, I'm not sure what it is, because they are just, it is pure and unadulterated joy for these dogs.
Yeah, they absolutely love it. And our dog Shock, just for example there, you know, as soon as we put a harness on her, the first time ever, she was ready to run, and she's becoming an excellent little sled dog without any training at all. We've had her in harness just a few times. We typically don't run our dogs until they're a year old in harness with the big teams. And I tell you what, that little dog, she has all the heart and will in the world, and I think she's going to become an excellent little sled dog for us. One other question in regards to Jerry, not in him particular, but at least in terms of withdrawn and scratched mushers. Do you know the difference? Is there any type of monetary penalty or anything like that if a dog team is withdrawn versus a scratch? It seems to be much harsher when you see that word withdrawal versus scratch.
I'm not sure technically if there is any kind of penalty that goes with being withdrawn. It's certainly something that is not looked upon as well. And I know that there are certain circumstances where a musher has been withdrawn that the Iditarod Trail Committee has taken disciplinary actions against that musher, you know, if there's some sort of serious misconduct that's involved.
And the only thing I can say to that in regards to withdrawal versus scratch, of course, scratch meaning it was the musher's choice at that point where he says, okay, I'm done, I'm going to scratch, whereas a withdrawal is typically the race organizer's choice. And of course, there's protest allowed when a musher
right.
is withdrawn. It typically does not happen. As we talked about Ramey Smith and his lead dog being pulled by the veterinarian, it typically does not happen until the race is over and they are in Nome and after everything's settled down before a protest will be heard. But that is one example of what can occur on a withdrawal versus a scratch, of course.
Yeah, and again, I think we covered this a little bit before, but the race officials are aware of the fact that withdrawing someone is a very serious step, and it, I don't think, is something that is ever done lightly or ever done without a full appreciation of what it means to the race, to the musher, and to everyone else.
Exactly. And we don't have it very often. I know the last time, as far as I can recall, the last withdrawal was in 2011 when we talked about that Rule 36 last night with Hank DeBruin and his dogs, and he was forced to withdraw. I don't think we had anything in 2012, did we, in terms of withdrawals?
I can't recall any, so no, I don't think so either.
Okay, so we have about 7 minutes to go, Alex. I know our topic of today was food bags or food drops. What do you have to say on that? Then I'll give my 2 cents.
Well, as followers of the race might know or might have seen at checkpoints, at every checkpoint there are bags that have the name of the checkpoint on them and then a musher name, and the mushers are required to drop off their food drop bags at a certain point before the race, several weeks before the race. I'm not sure what the exact timing is, and this is considered a very, very big deal because the mushers have to pay by the pound to ship out these food drop bags. It's, in a perfect world, you would be able to know exactly where you're going to stop and ship the right amount of food to that place and not have to ship anything anywhere else. But, of course, plans change, the race conditions change, the weather changes, and the trail changes. So, as a result, most mushers will end up sending food bags to all of the checkpoints or almost all of the checkpoints, at least to have a little bit of food for them to pick up at each checkpoint. Now, in addition to food for the dogs, these bags can contain and often do contain food that is meant for the mushers. So if a musher knows that he or she likes Snickers bars or a certain type of cookie or you know, macaroni and cheese or something like that, they can make up their own food and put that in the bag so that that's sent to the checkpoint as well. Now, because they have to send a lot of stuff to a lot of different places, there is a tremendous amount of the food and the other things in those bags that ends up not being used by the musher on the trail. And someone was asking a while ago, what happens to those food bags if the musher scratches or if the musher goes through the checkpoint and doesn't stop and doesn't get those things? And the answer to that is that they are opened up. If there's anything personal for the musher, such as sometimes people will send clothing or, you know, mittens or hats or things that they think they will need from that point forward in the race. So if there's anything like that, that is sent back to the musher. But the food that's there is not sent back. That food is distributed locally to dogs and to people at the various checkpoints. So, you know, you have a village in the middle of the interior that is a very small village, and suddenly you have 60 feed bags that arrive, and then sometimes, you know, maybe only 15 teams will actually use the stuff in the feed bags, and you'll have 45 bags left, and that will be distributed to the local dogs in the village. We had a bit of an issue this year because some of the food at some of the checkpoints, and I believe in particular Iditarod and some of the checkpoints a little bit before that, we had some reports that some of the food was spoiled. And there were a few mushers who were being very careful and making sure that they boiled all of their dog food and killed off any germs that might happen. Some mushers had food for themselves that they ended up throwing away because they thought it was spoiled. And in most cases, the food bags are piled up outside at the checkpoints, and they'll stay there for, you know, a week or 2 weeks just sitting there outside. Normally, that's not a problem because the temperature will be significantly below freezing, and it won't affect the quality of the food or won't spoil it. But this year, because we had such high temperatures, and in some cases in the sun, at certain points in the trail, it was up past 40 degrees, that might have led to some of the spoilage.
That's exactly right. And we have about 2 minutes left, Alex. I just want to run down very quickly what I put in my drop bags every time. And I make it a point pretty much to do the same thing every time. And when I'm making up drop bags, it takes a tremendous amount of work and effort to do that. And I'm just running mid-distance races. But if we run out of time here, we'll just continue on after the half hour. In terms of dogs, I always carry two meals in each drop bag. So it'll be two things of meat, two things of kibble, four bottles of heat to start the fire with, and at least two snacks. I typically snack my dogs every 2.5 to 3 hours on the trail. But when I'm planning my drop bags, I plan the drop bags as if that drop bag is going to be used down the trail, and then I will carry the other food that I had in the drop bag previous in the sled. So in case something happens down the trail, I will always have at least one meal, two snacks, ample heat, and ample kibble for the dogs in every checkpoint. And we're about out of time here, Alex. We're going to continue on. You're listening to Mushing Radio here on KBRF 89.5 FM. You can check out all of our podcasts on Mushing Radio, mushingradio.com. We will be here tomorrow. It'll be day 11 of our coverage. We will probably not have a winner by tomorrow night, but it's going to get pretty dang close after tomorrow's broadcast. So with that, again, send us your comments, questions, and concerns to DogWorks Radio on Twitter, Facebook, and at Coldfoot Films on Alex's feed. So with that, Alex, we are now recording, and it will be available here in just a little while on mushingradio.com. We were talking about food drops and what I put in my bags. Every time I pack a certain number of things in terms of personal use. I have an extra set of batteries. I have two pairs of knit gloves. I have a thing of Lifesavers, a couple of five-hour energies, something to eat a meal with, and an extra pair of socks. At every checkpoint, I try to have an extra pair of socks because there's nothing worse than having wet or cold feet down the trail, and I've learned from experience on having my feet frostbitten on a couple occasions. So that is something I carry every single time in every drop bag. And as we've mentioned on many occasions, a musher's gear can pretty much fit in a gallon Ziploc bag in a drop bag, whereas the dog food and the dog gear, whether it be coats and harnesses and all that other stuff, can equal up to 70 pounds. I think a lot of people have a misconception about that, about how much gear that a musher has for himself compared to the dog. It is almost overwhelmingly 90 to 95% of that drop bag is related to the dogs. Any other points you want to make on that?
Well, you covered it really well. I just wanted to emphasize as well that the object of having the drop bags is so that you make sure that there is always, no matter what the trail conditions, no matter what's going on with the race or with the team or with the musher, that you're always going to have ample food to be able to take care of your team. So if you are in a position where ordinarily it might just be a 6 or 7 hour run to the next checkpoint, but if there is a blizzard that comes in, it might take you 12 hours. So you're planning for the worst case scenario, and then you can evaluate as you're going through the checkpoint how much of that food you're going to need and how much you're not going to need and can just leave there because you'll get to the next place where the next drop bag is in plenty of time. And obviously, when you're racing, you want to carry what you need, but you don't want to carry a lot of extra weight as well.
That's exactly right, because you never know. And as we talked about earlier in the show, it should be a race between checkpoints, just piggybacking or leapfrogging from one checkpoint to another, hoping that when you get there, you can progress to the next one, or at least forecasting that you can to go to the next one. And like you said, out there on the trail, that six-hour run that you've calculated well into October or November with your plan can very quickly become that 16 or 17-hour long haul. And that can turn disastrous if you don't have the food and supplies for your dogs. Most of these mushers are feeding their dogs about every 6 hours, four times a day, 7 days a week. So they need to calculate that on the trail. If they figure, well, it's going to take me 6 hours to get from, Rainy Pass to Finger Lake, okay, well, I can feed my dogs one time there and not have to worry about it until I get to the next one. But, we've talked about many times, the coast is notorious for these storms. And when those move in, those 6 or 7 hour runs can turn into monotonous or enormous, not monotonous, enormous 16 or 17 hour runs very quickly.
Right. And the other thing to remember as well, and we say this all the time, but it's certainly worth repeating, is these are dogs who are serious, top-notch athletes. We're not talking your standard lap dog or house dog that you can feed once or twice a day and that's fine. We're talking about athletes who are competing at the top of their game who are going to need, 10, 11, 12,000 calories per day. So you really have to make sure that you're planning for that and that you're able to provide them with that fuel so that they can keep going.
And just a perspective on how much 10 to 12,000 calories is, it's about 24 Big Macs. That's a heck of a lot of calories.
Yeah.
Hopefully, they're not feeding their dog Big Macs, but at least you can get a sense of what those calories equal.
I was just going to say that.
All right. Yeah. Let's talk about our featured musher this evening. And again, we're recording here on Mushing Radio, and they'll be able to hear it later on if they missed a portion of it this afternoon. Let's talk about Nicholas Pettit. Pretty much an up-and-coming musher. He's doing very well. Where is he ranked at right now, Alex? Nicholas Pettit is our featured musher.
He is, I believe, in the top 10. I want to just double-check that. He's currently in Koyak, and he's 12th. So he's doing exceptionally well this year. This is his third Iditarod, and he's someone who has made a tremendous amount of progress every time he races. So he is a real up-and-comer, and I think someone who, if he sticks with it and keeps going the way he's been going, is someone who is definitely going to be a top contender, you know, in the next few years.
Totally agree there. You know what, before you get into your commentary about Nicholas, what I find very interesting, and every musher has their little quirks or stuff that they do every single race, and what I found this year by watching Nicholas and how he's doing it in the shorter distance races, and including the Iditarod, is Nicholas does something that's a little bit unorthodox to what a lot of mushers do. As soon as he starts a race, he has one of the sit-down sleds. He will sit down right after the start of the race, not because he's tired or not because of this or that, but for whatever reason, as soon as he starts his race, he sits down. Have you seen that in pictures, Alex?
I have. I've seen that a couple times outside of Willow, that he's actually been sitting down when he passes people and waving to them, which, as you pointed out, is an unusual thing.
It is. I think a lot of people say, well, wow, he just started. Why in the world does he need to sit down? But I guess that's his deal. You know, everybody has their superstitions and their quirks, and I guess that's his. I don't know why, other than he does it in every race, but I guess it's just his little way of starting each race. I find it very interesting. So what do you have on tap for us about Nicholas?
Okay, well, Nicholas was born in France, and he lived in the Normandy region of France until he was 12. And his mom got remarried and moved the family to New Mexico. And after high school and after he'd been through a couple years in college, he saved up some money and drove up to Alaska and kind of explored around Alaska for a while, ended up settling in Girdwood, which, if people are not familiar with Alaska, is a little bit south of Anchorage, maybe 45 minutes an hour south. It's where the Alyeska Resort is. There's a great ski resort there. You can ski while looking at the Turnagain Arm, which is a very cool thing to do. He's a big skier and snowboarder, and after he'd been in Girdwood for a while, a friend of his had huskies who had puppies and gave him a puppy from the litter, and he said that the only name that this puppy would answer to was Ugly. So he started, I assume affectionately, calling this dog Ugly. And he, in fact, has named his kennel after it. So his kennel is called Ugly Dog Mushing. Shortly after that, he went on a trip to Wyoming, and he went dog mushing with Iditarod veteran Billy Snodgrass. He had been kind of a recreational musher for a number of years, working construction jobs, doing some mushing on the side, apparently has worked almost everywhere there is to work in the Girdwood area, decided a couple years ago that he wanted to get serious about it and run the Iditarod, and he reported that he was in a restaurant in Girdwood, and this will show you that sometimes there are very, very different attitudes in Alaska than you might see other places. He was in a restaurant, and he noticed that the guy next to him smelled a little bit like dog poop. And so he said, rather than saying to himself, "This is disgusting, he smells like dog poop," he said to himself, "I bet he has sled dogs." And so he struck up a conversation with the guy. His name was Dario Martinez, and offered to help him out at his kennel, scooping poop and taking care of the dogs and exercising them, and just wanted to do anything that he could do in order to be around sled dogs. And then Dario Martinez in 2010 knew that Jim Lanier, Iditarod veteran Jim Lanier, was looking for someone to help out at his kennels. So Nick volunteered to help out at Jim Lanier's kennels in order so that he could learn more about it and use some of the dogs and complete some of his qualifiers. And then shortly before the race in 2011, Jim Lanier needed to have one of his hips replaced. And there's a rule in the Iditarod that you can withdraw for medical reasons and specify another racer to run with your team, provided that it's either an Iditarod veteran or someone who's completed all of his qualifying races. And Nick had just completed his qualifying races a couple weeks before then. So at the last minute, he stepped in to run Jim Lanier's team, which, as we talked about yesterday, is the white dogs, the all-white dogs. Even though he was stepping into a predetermined team, so he didn't have to worry about some of the things one has to worry about, like getting the dogs together, there still was an enormous cost associated with that. He had to pay for the food drops. He had to reimburse Jim Lanier for the entry fee. So instead of looking at a cost of $40,000 to $50,000, he was still looking at $20,000 to $30,000 that he had to raise within a period of about 45 days. So he kind of enlisted the entire community of Girdwood, got a lot of local businesses and a lot of friends there to either sponsor him or help out. The entire local Boy Scout troop helped him with putting his food drop bags together. Scott Jansen, whom we've talked about quite a bit, stepped up and offered to cover the cost of his food drops, of shipping the food out to the checkpoints. And Scott said, you know, he's one of these people that when you meet him in life, you instantly know that you're going to be friends for a really long time, and you just want to do whatever you can to help him. So he enlisted a bunch of local pet stores and the Rotary Club, and they organized trips up to Jim's kennel so that he could pack and get all of his food bags together. And he ran that race in 2011 and finished very respectably in 28th place. And then after that, he started working with the Reddingtons, and for the past 2 years has been running a team of Reddington dogs, and finished last year in 29th place. And this year it looks like he's definitely going to be in the top 20 and has a chance for a top 10 finish.
Very cool. How old is Nick?
Nick is, I believe, 32.
32. So, yeah, he's right now in 12th place, and he is in Koyuk at this time, making his way down the trail, doing very well. I know you had mentioned on Twitter this afternoon, or one of your East Coast Twitter buddies, we have to give a shout-out to them. They're requesting it, so we have to give a shout-out to those guys. You talked about the Most Improved Musher Award, and my comment to that was Jake Berkowitz, who I believe his best finish was 31st, and now he's currently in 7th place. But Nick has a chance for that as well. Can you give us a little bit of a history on that award, or what the qualifications are? I'm a little bit sketchy on it.
Yeah, that award is given to the musher who makes the best improvement in terms of the number of places that they move up from their last finish. So it doesn't have to be a finish from last year. They do have to have finished the Iditarod before. But so the last time they finished from that until their place this year is how they determine it. So if you move up 25 places, then that's considered an enormous amount. And Ali Zirkel has won this award in the past. I'm not sure who won it last year, but it's considered a very, very prestigious award. And it's certainly a sign that certainly a sign that someone is moving from being kind of a middle of the pack musher to being a serious contender.
And, you know, from my understanding, the Iditarod gives out some pretty dang cool prizes for each one of these awards, whether they're sponsored by somebody else, whether it be, Wells Fargo or the Pinair that does the very cool mask at one of the checkpoints. Do you have any idea what that award is symbolized by, or is it just a trophy or a plaque?
I believe it's a plaque, and I know it's sponsored by Horizon. So I think it's a plaque, and there's probably cash involved with it as well.
Cash is always good for a mushroom, no matter how much it is.
Yeah, it's an engraved trophy plus $2,000.
There you go. That'll buy a couple of months of dog food on a medium-sized kennel for sure. So I think it'll definitely help out whoever wins that award. I think it will be Jake Berkowitz if my history stands corrected. Or do you have any idea on who you think it'll be?
Yeah, I also think it'll be Jake. I just wanted to point out about Nick, and I don't know if we put this picture up. If not, we will. There's a great picture from the Turnagain Times of Nick at the ceremonial start in Anchorage, and you can see he's got his dog, Ugly, who is a strange but wonderful-looking dog, on the harness. He just ran Ugly for the ceremonial start, did not take the dog on the actual race, but wanted to include this dog who has been such a big part of his mushing experience for those 11 miles in Anchorage.
Definitely check out our Facebook page for that, and it'll follow on over to Twitter at Dogworks Radio on Twitter and Facebook. Alex, we're about 45 minutes into the show this evening. What is happening in the next 24 hours? We're getting close.
Well, you know, in the next 24 hours, we're going to see teams heading into White Mountain, and from White Mountain, there's the mandatory 8-hour rest. So it looks at the moment, and obviously things can change pretty quickly, but it looks like Mitch Seavey is probably going to be the first musher into White Mountain.
Yeah, and remember, folks, that at White Mountain they have to take that mandatory 8-hour rest, so you're going to see everybody resting there at White Mountain before that final push into Nome. What is the mileage from White Mountain into Nome?
I believe it is about 77 miles.
So definitely a run that they can do in a day without any problems at all, but probably 8 to 12 hours at the fastest or the slowest. So we're looking forward to having a winner very shortly after those first four or five mushers get into White Mountain. So we're looking towards the end of the race. And remember, folks, just one last thing here is we're going to cover at least a few days after the race. So just because those big names are done, I want to cover some of the guys that a lot of folks don't know about. I know we try to do that every evening when we talk about our featured musher, but there's a heck of a lot of mushing going on after these first groups of mushers get into Nome, isn't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, just at the back of the pack right now, we have four mushers that we've been pretty much regularly. Cindy Abbott is currently the Red Lantern. She's at Grayling. Also resting at Grayling are Bob, how do you pronounce his last name?
Klupach.
Klupach? Yep. I don't know why I stumble over that every time I try to say it. James Volek and Jan Steves. Jan Steves and Bob Klupach have been traveling together for most of the race, and also traveled together for most of the race last year. And James Volek and Cindy Abbott have sort of fallen into traveling about together for the past 100, 150 miles or so.
And just one point to make on Bob and Jan. They share kennel duties and kennel dogs and just about everything up here in Willow. They just live a few miles up the road from me. Bob and a friend of ours spent the summer a couple of years ago replacing my roof. So I got to learn and find out quite a bit about old Bob. He and I have shared a lot of stories. So I consider Bob a good friend of mine, and I've met Jan and raced with her a few times. So those guys often will run together. I know last year they finished the race together with Jan claiming that Red Lantern Award just a few minutes or miles ahead of Bob. So it's a great story. Maybe we'll talk about one of those guys tomorrow night on our featured musher. Anything else in closing, Alex?
You know, we're getting to the point where there are a few teams that are starting to run a little bit low on dogs. And when you get towards the coast, a lot of teams will drop dogs that are not performing all that well. But there are a few teams that have 9 dogs and 2 teams that have only 8 dogs. And, you know, you have to start worrying when you're only down to that many dogs about whether if anything happens to your remaining dogs, you know, and they are underperforming or get an injury, that your race could be over if you only have 8 dogs in harness.
That's exactly right. Right now, Dallas Seavey has 8, and that's by design. He said many a times that's how he likes to finish the race with 8. Jesse Royer has 8. And Josh Kadzow, a rookie, only has 9, at least in the top 20. That's what we're dealing with. So, like you said, if one of those dogs becomes injured, they have to finish in harness, not in the bag. They have to finish in harness with 8. So we might need to start looking at that for some of these guys. We don't want to wish ill will by any stretch of the imagination, but man, that's a scary thing to do, to start dropping all of your dogs and then one or two go down for any amount of things, whether it be splits in their paws or a sore shoulder or diarrhea or stress or whatever, you can lose a dog team relatively quickly in a short amount of time. So with that, Alex, we've rambled on for a long time tonight. I'm glad to have you here. We'll talk again tomorrow, okay?
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
All right, so on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, calling in from sunny California, and my name is Robert Forto. We'll see you guys tomorrow night, same time. Goodbye.